What's up, peeps? Before you get into the episode, just a quick message. Did you know that Rebranded Safety is brought to you by RiskFluent? Rebranded Safety is essentially our campaign to achieve our purpose, which is to make the working world better by rebranding safety one interaction at a time. We value a people-centered approach that delivers positive impact on the risk. We deliver three types of services: technical, transformational, and fire. It's the last two I want to talk to you about. If you value what we value and you want some support driving a culture change or decluttering your safety systems, or you want to improve human performance, then it's our transformational support that can help you. Or maybe you want a highly experienced registered fire risk assessor to carry out an assessment on your building, design an emergency plan, or review the fire safety design for your new building, then it's our fire support service that can help you. But before you get in touch with us, it's important that you want to have impact on the actual risk and you value a people-centered approach. If you don't, that's fine. You'll find someone that can help you. But if you do value those, then get in touch with us at riskfluentltd.com or email me, james@riskfluentltd.com. But for now, I'll let you get into the episode.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranded Safety. It's part three of our quarterly co-host with Rob. Unfortunately, that's the last episode and this quarterly co-host. Make sure you listen to the end of today's episode where I tell you who our next quarterly co-host is. But for the meantime, let's jump into the intro and I'll tell you some more about today's episode.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by RiskFluent.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to change the perception of health and safety. We do it right here on the podcast and the YouTube channel as well. So if you're new, hit that subscribe button. Okay, so it's the last episode of our quarterly co-host. Rob, thank you very much for coming on and being our quarterly co-host. I'm really enjoying this segment of quarterly co-host. Little bit of a slightly different style, which I'm really enjoying. Make sure you listen to the end of today's episode to hear about the next quarter's quarterly co-host. But for the time being, this is the last episode with Rob. So thank you very much and I hope you've enjoyed it. And if you are enjoying this quarterly co-host segment, please let us know or leave a rate and review because that really helps us. And ultimately, if you don't feed back to us, then we don't really know if we're doing it right and whether you're enjoying it. So, you know, if you think there's something needs tweaking, let us know as well. So thank you very much for those of you that do that. Just a quick shout out from our sponsors then. Thank you very much to Paradigm Human Performance and more specifically their HSE subscription service for sponsoring the YouTube channel and podcast. Without Paradigm, we couldn't keep continually improving what we're doing and upping our content and pushing the boundaries of what content in the safety risk profession looks like, which is traditionally really plain and boring. So Paradigm Human Performance's HSE subscription service then, the perfect solution for those of you that are listening that are small and medium-sized enterprise, maybe you work for an SME, maybe you are the SME, you're the founder yourself and you're spinning all of those plates and juggling all of those balls and it's just absolutely mad. And sometimes safety just falls by the wayside, you know, not by choice because we know that you all care, but ultimately it just falls out of sight. And, you know, that's life. But unfortunately, when it hits a proverbial fan, then it doesn't really help. So it's really good to have somebody like Paradigm at your side, somebody that can come in and have a look at what you're doing and see if you need some help, some upgrading, so to speak. Paradigm Human Performance's HSE subscription service is built by HOP professionals, human organizational professionals. So it's got the new view of safety woven throughout it. It puts worker safety at the DNA of your company. It's going to help you understand how to utilize the subject matter expertise of the worker, one of the things that we fall down the most with. So if you're an SME and you're thinking, I need to make sure that I'm a little bit better on my legal, regulatory, compliance stuff, but I want to do it with someone who's a bit more kind of new viewy, then this is the perfect solution for you. This is not the kind of system you're going to have to declutter in 5 years' time once you've read a couple of Todd's books or Sydney's books. You know, this is the right solution for you. And if you're not sure about Paradigm because you've only heard about them from me, then you can go check them out at their learning organization webinar at the website, which is linked in the description below. You can log in and you get access to all the old webinars, and you get to go then to every Thursday at 2 p.m. and it's just phenomenal conversations. I'm there give or take nearly every week, along with an amazing community. And the chat box is nuts. It's great. And the conversation on the webinar is good. There's just so much content there. So go check them out. All the Paradigm team are normally there, or the most of them are normally there. So you can check them out as well. And you get a feel for them. You can see their expertise before you buy it. Their support, basically. A kind of try before you buy, if you will. If you don't want to do that and you want to get straight into it, then there's a phone number and an email address in the description below, and you can contact Paradigm Human Performance straight away. Thank you very much, Paradigm, for sponsoring this channel. And finally, just a shout out from me and Colin Nottage and our company in Project Meletium. Project Meletium is a mastermind community, the only mastermind community for the safety and risk profession. This is all focused on building a community of people that get together on a regular basis, weekly, in fact, and we just help each other solve our problems. We comfort each other, we support each other, we celebrate each other, and we just help each other become better. It's all about building a better profession. That's what we want to do. And we do that with our community, and we just facilitate that process. So you can join Project Meletium, and you get access to weekly community calls every Friday and every Wednesday. And as we're growing really quick now, it seems like we might have to add a breakfast call soon. So we've got an evening call, a lunchtime call, and we're looking to add a breakfast call soon. And these community calls are turning out to be just phenomenal. The best offer, basically, that we think is around, and all of our members are feeding back, being like, do not change your community calls. They are phenomenal. We love them, and our members love them. We also run book clubs. We also run a philosophy call. This helps us get to the foundations of what all these things are that we're discussing. We discuss risk and safety all the time, but do we actually understand really what it is? You can only do that through philosophical discussions, and that's why we do that. And they're hosted by the amazing Simon Casson, who runs Ouch Training. So go check him out as well. So if that sounds like the community for you, if you want to become a better safety professional, a better risk professional, whatever, go to www.projectmeletium.com. Just go check it out, or you can try it for free by just messaging me or Colin. We'll get you in one of our community calls. You can try it out for free. I'll hopefully see you at one of our calls soon. Okay, without further ado, let's get into the last conversation of this quarter's quarterly co-host with Rob Fisher. Right, mate, welcome back to the podcast for the last of our quarterly co-host.
I can't believe it's been a month.
I know, right? It feels like us, we've just spoke like three or four times, just bing, bang, bong. But it actually, like, it's been a quarter of the year. It's like, it's weird. When this gets out, it'll be like the way ahead. And we won't even remember this conversation.
Right. We're probably going to be talking about things that won't even apply by the time we're talking about them.
We might be like, remember what we used to speak about in that quarterly co-host? That's wrong. That's a load of shit.
Did I say that? Yeah.
None of that's grounded in the science.
The science changed. It changed. Oh, wait, that's happening now.
Oh, shit, yeah. And such is the problem with all of this scientific approach. I think everyone's just so desperate for this kind of... I think we've seen that so much in COVID as well, with like... I think it was a really interesting conversation around like face coverings and stuff. No matter what your opinion on it is, it's like, well, there's no evidence to say they work. And I'm like, well, yeah, because we've never been in this situation before. So there's no science to do it. And then when we get like, so in the beginning, everyone's like, oh, you know, face coverings, then they're not proven to work. So don't use them, blah, blah, blah. Look, our government came out and said, well, but then they were like, oh, actually, they do work. Everyone should start wearing them. Well, 6 months ago, you said don't wear them. Well, yeah, because 6 months ago, we didn't have any fucking science, but now we do.
So we just give us some time. We can't just pull the science out of our orifice. It's like science is just constantly changing, yeah, contradicting itself. And I think a lot of people find that really uncomfortable to deal with.
Well, it's funny, you know, to tie some of this a little bit back into hop discussions and really rebranding safety discussions. Mm. You know, we could say that the pyramid was all we had to convince people of 20, 30 years ago. Mm. We had to get people to shift to focus on different things. Were they the right things? Were they perfect? No. Do we think that the focus on the pyramid saved lives and shifted thinking and made people look at different things? You're damn right. That doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't mean we haven't evolved. Well, I have this picture that I put up when I do some introductory sessions, and it's a picture of a hummingbird and a bumblebee. And what those two things have in common is they have flown for millions of years without us understanding how they do it. Mm. And it was only until the early 20th century that we discovered that we could build a helicopter that shouldn't fly according to the physics of the day under those same principles. Mm. And now we can lift massive objects with helicopters over a very short period of time. From about the early 1900s to now, we can lift massive components with a helicopter that we didn't even know the physics of 100 years ago. And it's the same with human and organizational performance, or same with rebranding safety. These things that we know now, we have to build on those. Mm. It doesn't mean that humans have changed. What it means is that we now understand humans better than we ever have in human history.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about personality tendencies, we base them off the ancient Chinese. For thousands of years, they have understood how some people are more fiery. Some people are more down to earth or grounded. Some people are more cool and calm as water. Some people are like the squirrel, like the wind. And those then became the doer, the thinker, the socializer, the relator, the e-colors of red, green, blue, and yellow. Mm. It's an evolving understanding of the science. Yeah. And that's the key, is we understand the science. The fact that masks work or didn't work was our understanding, not the physics of the mask. So that grounding in science, you know, it winds up being important.
And it's so true. And I think that there's like an uncomfortable, there needs to be like an uncomfortable acceptance in that you're never there. Like you're where you are now, but ultimately there'll be another report in a couple of months' time or years' time that tells you that where you are now is not where you should be, because we've learned something else. And I think that the triangle is a great example of that, because I think we worked off that for a long time, and then we found out, oh, it's not, you know, it doesn't work, it doesn't make sense. And then Carsten Busch has done a lot of work in this space as well, and he's, you know, a lot of the work that he's now doing is saying, actually, when, yes, the triangle is technically wrong, but actually the triangle is not wrong. How we've used it is wrong.
Exactly.
And so our understanding of the triangle now, thanks to Carsten and some others, their work on using local rationality to try and understand what Heimrich was trying to achieve, we can now understand the triangle better because we understand the science better to be able to say, actually, the triangle works, but for each individual kind of hazard type or event type, not for each individual whole organization.
Yeah, it works for a task. We call it managing the slice.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it's not the pyramid for the organization. It's for this task.
Yeah.
And it may go as far as this person on this task at this time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the same, I've been asked a few times, like, oh, rebranding safety, is that all about getting us from safety one to safety two, or old view to new view? And I'm like, well, maybe at the moment it is, but it's not like that forever, because at some point the new view will at some point be the old view. And so for me, like, the question, and I've been asked this before, is like, when have you achieved to rebranded safety? You have rebranded it? Never, hopefully, because whatever we rebrand it to, we'll need to rebrand it again in another 10 years or 5 years or 20 years or whatever. And then we'll need to rebrand it again. And it's a constant perpetual cycle. So I see my work as just a constant challenge to hold us all to account, to say, are we evolving? Are we rebranding the way we keep each other safe?
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite quotes is all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what you and I do really for a living and a lifestyle. And it's how we're cut. We're born to help that, to help things evolve. I very often say, you know, there's three kinds of people. There's explorers, there's pioneers, and there's settlers. Mm. And we've always kind of considered ourselves in the explorer and pioneer, and then we'll let other people settle. Mm. But some of the challenges, you know, going back to the things we're talking about, whether it's rebranding safety, safety one, safety two, safety differently, HOP, is sometimes the settlers take over take over the town, which is fine, but then they try to run the expansion.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, you can look in the towns around you and see how that works.
Yeah.
where the people that are out there really looking for change, really looking for, it's not, I don't like to say the next new thing, but the next new thing, you know, the next phase or the next generation of what we do that we then need to rebrand. There still have to be people out there like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's up to people like you and I to go find those folks along the way. If not, the settlers will run it.
Yeah. And it's also like, you need all of those, don't you? You need the settlers to kind of run the, you know, there is nothing wrong in being that kind of guy that just wants things to be as they are. Because ultimately, for a period of time, each time this cycle of kind of scientific evolution comes around, there is a period of settling in between each one of those. And you wouldn't want somebody, an explorer, just running everything all the time. But Jesus, like, there's got to be some kind of settle. We'll all be knackered.
There's a couple of companies that are very famous right now that's happening, right?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think you see that in like entrepreneurial kind of things that have blown up. And I think it's a good example. You see those companies where you've got those people who just love building companies, trying new things out and exploring new beyond, I suppose. And like people always kind of look at Richard Branson as a kind of popular example at the moment. As always, a great businessman. No, he's not. He's an entrepreneur. He doesn't actually run or own any of those organizations. He builds them, gets them to a point, and then he buggers off because he's bored of it now.
He's smart enough to find people that can.
Exactly. So he finds the person that can settle there, can hold it, maintain it, and keep it as it is. That's what he does. Then he buggers off because he's acknowledged in his head, this is what I'm good at. I'm good at finding a new idea or solving a problem. I'm building it. Once it's built, I'm bored shitless and I want to move on. And I get that. I really get that. Anyway, this is all kind of related, I think.
It's completely related because one of the things that we, so I'm Rob Fisher, for those of you who may have forgotten.
You should from know a month him by ago. Now.
Yeah. You should know me by now. I own a company called Fisher Improvement Technologies, and we've spent the last 30 years and 3 months now. Since we've been doing this for 3 months.
And how many weeks and days?
Yeah, no, I don't know about that. helping organizations and individuals understand how and why people make mistakes, you know, especially mistakes that can prove to be catastrophic, and how you can either prevent those mistakes, minimize their probability, or reduce their consequences, mitigate their consequences. That's really the only things you can do with human error. So you have to understand and learn how to manage it. And I really appreciate James of Rebranding Safety for having me on, because we spent the first session of our time together talking about leaders and leader strategy. And it all starts there. And whether you're rebranding safety or doing safety differently or trying to establish a just culture or trying to implement the concepts of human and organizational performance, the strategy for leaders matters. And you have to give them tools just like you give the worker tools. You got to give them processes and you have to change their paradigm. You got to give them a better paradigm, better than the one you're asking them to leave. And then last month, we talked a little bit about, we called it workforce buy-in and engagement, but the reality is it's engagement with the concepts, engagement with each other, engagement with the leaders. And oddly enough, we circled back to that leader attribute quite frequently during our workforce discussion about how do we involve the workforce in the process? How do we get them to interact? And how do we use those engagements? And then most importantly, how do we integrate the concepts into the day-to-day work? And so the third session, we wanted to talk about strategies for deployment and how do you go about moving down the road? And there's really three phases that we're going to talk about. Education, people have to get new information. And that new information drives them to learn something new. They gain knowledge. Integration, you've got to then put that knowledge into the day-to-day workflow. And then sustainability, you have to create the mechanism that makes this how we do business. So that you now have the organizational capacity and you're resilient so that you become highly reliable. It's the creation of a highly reliable system as opposed to going out and trying to buy high reliability. So hope I didn't take over too much, but that kind of encapsulates where we've been and where we're going.
Yeah, I like that. And I think as well, just to kind of point out on that last thing you said there, like, we've kind of gone through those three steps, or by the end of this session, we will have gone through those kind of three kind of key steps to go through to start your journey in this kind of change. But it's not, like you've just kind of alluded to there, to go out and buy high reliability. You can't go out and buy this off the shelf. Like, this is you can get a consultant to come and help you out 100%. And a lot of those concepts are probably a bit of a standardized approach, which we touched on last week. But ultimately, I suppose how you go about the journey and the start is quite unique to each company and your maturity, I suppose. Rob, would you agree? Or,
well, the deployment piece. So you have deployment and integration as part of that, those first pieces. The deployment piece is really pretty standard. We've got about three deployment models. It depends on size and company capability. And those have just been developed over time. And now we really have added a fourth, because we can do things online and virtually, where before almost everything was done in person. But there's only really three ways to go about it that we've found successfully. That doesn't leave out the 15 or 20 we probably tried along the way. Or, you know, we come across a client that says, well, you know, we like what you're saying, but we know this works for our organization. And you have to let them try that. But most of those came back to one of those three education elements. Mm. You know, here's what we know has to be in there. Here's the minimum standard for what someone needs to know about these concepts for them to be successful and you to be successful as an organization. I don't know anything in life that doesn't have a minimum standard of knowledge associated with it.
Well, yeah, because you have to know how to do the thing, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, you started podcasting. And admittedly, I mean, we met right near the start of your podcasting career. At the start of that, and, you know, I have a podcast, the Essential Leadership Cycle podcast. We didn't know much about that. So we looked to people that did. We talked to the Jay Allens and talked to people that did it and found out what some of the rules were that would help. We had to learn how to do that.
Oh, I didn't. I just downloaded an app. So my minimum knowledge was, I listened to a podcast that said, here's an app that can you can start a podcast. And I plugged it in, downloaded it, plugged the headset in, and just went, fuck it. Let's see what happens. I pressed record. And I'm literally coming off a dog walk. I'm literally hanging off the end of my sofa, just going, nah, nah, nah. And then I listened to it back and went, oh, that sounds pretty good. Upload. And then I was like, screw it, I'll do a couple more. So there was a minimum knowledge, granted, yeah.
Right.
But I think that minimum knowledge is kind of relative, isn't it? My minimum knowledge is different from your, depending on what you're trying to achieve. For me,
exactly,
it was an experiment. For you, it was probably kind of more of a business strategy initially. Therefore, quality was maybe a higher priority for you.
Yeah. So that's a great point. And the reality is that people don't enter into this realm if it's not important.
Mm.
They come in for three reasons: business, quality, or safety. Mm. That's the three reasons a company does hop.
Yeah.
If you shift over to rebranding safety, there's one reason they do it. What they don't realize is the more you know about rebranding safety, the better your quality is going to be.
Yeah.
Because you can't do the concepts that we talk about. And this is a piece of the education. You can't do the concepts that we talk about without impacting quality, safety, effectiveness, efficiency, and productivity.
Yeah, definitely.
Because the air doesn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of like, that's so reminiscent of what I'm doing in my day job. Like, we're building a framework for our industry that I'm kind of going through it. And I'm like, do you know what? If I call this something to do with health and safety, I'm literally missing so many opportunities because, you know, we're taking so much inspiration from human organizational performance, high reliability industries, resilience science, safety differently. We're taking all of those and safety too, and all of that. And we're taking all the inspiration from those. We're taking bits out and we're playing around with it and tweaking it to the language and the style of our industry and creating this framework. And I'm like, if we call this safety, anything safety, it's a wasted opportunity. So we've kind of gone down the route of calling it like operational risks, because it ticks a box for quality. It ticks a box for performance. It ticks a box for environment. It's ticking all of those boxes, because ultimately what we're talking about here is human and organizations performing ergonomically together and succeeding ergonomically, I suppose.
Yeah. It's human and organizational performance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, too many people get lost in the HP, human performance, or HOP.
Yeah.
It's the concepts that make the human and the organization perform better.
Yeah.
And so the education needs to mix those up. One of the biggest comments that we've gotten across the entire time that we've been doing this, and again, just to remind people, that's been 25 or 30 years and over 350,000 students globally. So we've been able to collect some comments along the way. One of the biggest realizations from the senior leaders and the managers is, hey, you know what? This doesn't just apply to safety. We could use these same concepts in quality. So when you talk about that task-based system, the individual surrounded by other people, programs, processes, work environments, organization, equipment, you say, yeah, that individual in that middle of that system can be doing quality work. They can be doing safety work. They can be doing environmental work. They can be doing finance work. They can do, you name it, they can be mowing a lawn.
They're doing work, aren't they? Which incorporates all of those.
Everything. And it includes home.
Mm.
So if you're teaching your 14-year-old how to mow the garden, then you can use the task-based system to make sure that they do that safer.
Yeah.
But you could also say, well, you know, my significant other has a very special way that they like to see the lawn. They like to see these nice diagonal stripes across the garden when we're done. So if I'm going to transfer that
to the 14-year-old fucking self, if she wants it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And absent that, since, you know, after I healed from the black eye, you tell the 14-year-old, hey, from a quality perspective or a process perspective, here's what needs to happen. From a safety perspective, this thing's spinning 1,000 miles a minute, and one touch and you could cut off a finger or a toe. You know, having those discussions that nobody had with us can really impact the way that that task happens. And that task happens, what, a million times a day somewhere in the world?
So I also think to bring it back to like your initial point of education on this, like people having to learn new things and how to do them. I think sometimes it's about understanding all of those little components in there. So if we kind of understand mowing the lawn, let's kind of keep that as an example. I think one thing that we don't do very well, Rob, is explain how we've designed out the risk. So like mowing the lawn, we don't explain, hey, this is called a dead man switch to make sure that you got both hands on this mower. So you're not going to put your hand under the blade while it's running or something like that.
And I'm going to cut the zip tie that I use off of it so that it works for you.
Yeah, exactly. because, you know, that's just do as I say, not as I do. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And like we want these diagonal lines because I don't know, because your mum's a bit weird and she likes diagonal lines on the right. lawn, but ultimately it's your mum's house. So suck it up.
Yeah, and get it exactly. done.
But just that explanation, I find that education of not just the new things, but the existing things as well.
Yeah.
Is really important.
Do you mind if I tell a story about that?
No, I like stories.
And, you know, sometimes we're still going to miss because we're fallible. We're fallible humans, but at least we have reduced probability. Mm. So a guy thought, you know, the whole 14-year-old mowing the lawn thing evolved from this story. He has a ride on mower and about 2 acres. And so it was about time to transfer the chore to his son, and he went, you know, he took out the task-based system. He did a pre-job brief, or what we would think is a pre-job brief. At the start of the summer, said, this summer we're going to do this. He walked him down, did all the things you were talking about. When you stand up off the mower, the reason it shuts off is so that the blades aren't still turning. The reason why you can't make the blades turn when you're doing this is so that this won't happen. And he said, now here's the way we want to approach it. In the spring, you're going to start with the deck on number 4. And then after a month, you're going to move it to 2. And then you're going to move it to 1 so that we start to mow the grass down as it grows. And as he tells the story, the first week he went out there, he did that job briefing and he stood out there and watched his kid mow the yard. And, you know, had a beer and just watched him and, you know, thumbs upped him, you know, watched him and was the second time that the kid mowed the yard. He put it down to 2, the deck down to 2. And the dad observed that, went in the house and came out, peeked out a couple of times, waved out the window, and it was good. The third time the dad said, well, he knows what he's doing. He left. And this is the importance of the difference between a job briefing and a task briefing. We're still in education, right? A job briefing says, this is how this all works. A task briefing says, this is how this task is going to work. What he forgot was that about 3/4 of the way back in their property, there was an old wellhead that stuck up in the ground. And that wellhead, the only time you had to mow around it was when you were on, when the mower deck was on 1 or 0. Every other time, the mower blades would just go right over it. So he left. His wife was still in the house. The son hit the wellhead. The blade broke and came up through, and he had 60 stitches in his thigh.
Oh, God.
From the blade breaking. And the dad really punished himself because he had gone through all of these things to try to prevent something bad from happening. And he forgot that one. Mm-hmm. But had they done a pre-task briefing, they probably would have had that discussion. And the discussion, back to our verbalization chat last month, that discussion would have probably spawned the, oh yeah, don't forget about this wellhead back there. You have to mow around that.
Yeah, I like that story. I think there's such a power in those well-rehearsed, maybe well-structured pre-job briefs or pre-task briefs, to use your kind of phrasing, in that, right, we're at the job. Like, and I've said this to so many customers, members, you know, like so many colleagues as well. Like, do you do kind of pre-job briefs? Well, when in the morning, when we're collecting the vans, we all just say hi, and the boss says, this is what we're all doing today. No, I mean pre-job brief. So when that crew turns up on site, or when your lads turn up at the machine, right, what are we trying to achieve for this task, for this job? And is anything different from our risk assessment, RAMS, mission method statement, whatever you want to call it? You know, is there any deviation today? Well, yeah, the risk assessment says work on the roof, and we don't need edge protection because we've got harness, but it's pissing it down, and it's windy AF today. So there's a slight deviation there. What do we think? And you just spark that conversation. Yeah. Maybe in your story, shouldn't we gone, you know, is there anything different about today? And then somebody would have gone, oh, yes, you're on level two on the mower today, aren't you? Yeah, that means that there's going to be a different job, because you're going to hit that yeah, kind of pipe or whatever it was. And then I also think we undervalue, well, actually, I don't think we undervalue, because I don't think we do it, post-job briefs either. Like, especially when nothing goes wrong, or when the day is just normal day, we've succeeded. Yeah. I'm getting to the end of that, and it's such a powerful question at the end of the job, is to say, our rules, procedures, risk assessments, did they work for today?
Yeah.
That workers imagine gap would just start to shrink if everybody's asking that question at the end of the day.
We thought it was so important that, you know, a lot of major companies do pre-job briefs, but they haven't really moved to the task. We thought it was so important that we wrote a free app that anybody can download, that 7 questions. What am I getting ready to do? Do I understand the task? Is there anything about my personality tendencies that could adversely impact the task? Do any of these traps exist today? What can go wrong? How could I get in a situation that I shouldn't be in? What's the worst credible thing that can happen? Under what conditions should I stop the task, and can I do it safely?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we created that, and that that app can be downloaded for free, and people can carry around the ability to do those pre-task briefings in their phone. Mm. They can pull it up and do it at any time, under any conditions. So we thought it was so important that we start to move to have those discussions and those engagements, because if you don't do that well, it makes the debrief more difficult. Mm. If you don't get in the habit of pre-task briefing, it's really hard to get in the habit of post-task reviews.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also, Rob, like, I don't want people to kind of listen to this and go, oh yeah, yeah, okay, right. So I'm going to go and I'm going to write like a 4-page checklist. Like, no, a checklist is a different tool. A checklist is something else. A brief is a conversation. That's like a group of lads, a group of girls, and you know, whatever, standing there and going, what's different today? What could go wrong today? Like, how powerful is that question?
Right.
What could go wrong today? Well, we're just about to break ground, so there could be any number of services under the ground. Okay, what have we done to make sure that we don't breach the services? And then just start that conversation. What if the paperwork was wrong and there actually is services down there? Like, that's something that could go wrong. What do we think? And just entertain that conversation. And I just think it's so powerful. Get people good. You know, I think it's a series of no more than about 4 or 5 questions, like you've said, good open question that facilitate a conversation. Don't overcomplicate this. And I don't know about what your opinion would be on like recording that. Like, I understand you've got the app, but like, let's say we didn't have that app and it wasn't free to everybody, or it was paid and people didn't have the budget. What do you think about people having to write down or record that brief? Do you, I mean, yeah. What do you think? Do you think it kind of brings
I think there's two, out? I think there's two levels. If we're doing a known high risk task that we're going to use a checklist for, there's a checklist for a reason. Pilots do a checklist for a reason. Aircraft mechanics do a checklist for a reason. People doing switching orders in utility do a checklist for a reason.
Yeah.
If we're doing a known or suspected high risk task, that's when you need the checklist.
Yeah.
In this one, in fact, you have the ability to record or not, but in our app, it's not saved unless you mail it to somebody.
Yeah.
So it's about leading the conversation. And that question is great. What could go wrong? Here's what we've discovered. When you ask the question, what could go wrong today? The question, what's different, is fantastic. When we ask what could go wrong, we usually get the answer to the question, what has gone wrong? So we have that discussion of things that we know have gone wrong. Yeah. When we ask the next level question, what's the worst credible thing that can happen? We get a completely different answer. Because now people are using their creative brain to say, okay, I've got two criteria. It's the worst and it's credible. Mm. So when you have that conversation, it's a very rich conversation. So somebody says, well, we could all die. Okay, tell me how that could happen. Well, I mean, it's an excavation. So if we don't control it right, somebody could fall in and the walls could cave in. Okay, what are we doing to prevent about that? Because, you know, we didn't have that conversation on what could go wrong. On what could go wrong, you said, well, the walls could cave in. There was nothing about how James could be standing on the edge and be taken in. Mm. That didn't come out until what's the worst thing that can happen. Mm. And if you protect against what the worst thing that can happen is, you start really protecting against some of the other things that could go wrong.
Yeah. And I think it's your kind of two points that we first got, is that kind of education and integration. And I suppose we're more talking about integration here. Well, I think you kind of mentioned in that, like, not just regulating those concepts, but it becoming how we do business. And I think that's kind of what we're touching on here. That's just how we do business, because I think we talk a lot about these pre-job briefs, and all the examples that both you and I have given are all kind of front sharp end kind of examples. But I mean, wouldn't it be nice to hear a leader ask those same questions when they're making a decision on cutting a budget? You know, right, we're going to cut operational budget. Okay, what could go wrong? What could go wrong with that? Well, we're cutting that budget. What's that budget? It's a maintenance budget. Well, we're cutting a maintenance budget. What could go wrong there? Well, really, that could mean that we're pushing our machine to the edge. So the interlocking guard might not work, which means somebody might go in there and lose a hand. Or it could mean that the quality of the product is harder for us to maintain, therefore meaning we're throwing more raw materials at it because we're wasting more. How powerful would it be if we had those pre-task briefs at all levels throughout the organization?
So it's great that you say that, because now we can go all the way back to 2 months ago and talk about leader education.
Yeah.
When they say who should be in the room, I say all the senior leaders, finance people, human resources people, safety people, quality people. They say, well, why the finance person? So I was doing a manager class that the chief financial officer for a pretty major company was sitting in on, and she had pushed herself to the last manager class of a string of about 15 of them. And so she was one of the last people into the last class, because they had a requirement that all leaders shall attend this class, right? You know?
Yeah.
And we're sitting there and we start talking about verbalized point and touch. And she goes white and says, do you mind if I share a story with you? And we said, no, not at all. She says, well, last week, we kind of got the final word that we were no longer going to be the provider of choice for a very major client. And she says, I've really struggled with that as a leader, because 5 months ago, we had a person in the finance department that was working off an Excel spreadsheet and billed this client $500,000 instead of $5 million. They owed us $5 million. The person billed them $500,000 and they paid it. And then we caught it. And we said, you know, we're very sorry. You owe us $4.5 million more dollars. And it was completely our error. And
oh, that's so embarrassing.
Not only was it embarrassing, it was a value that the chief financial officer had to deal with their chief financial officer on. If it had come in on the invoice, that company would have just paid it. So their CFO tells the lady that's sitting in the room, said, how do we know you haven't charged us the other way on some of these if you make mistakes like this?
Yeah.
And so the CFO went to the CEO and said, look, we're a little bit at risk here. And ultimately they lost a $20 or $30 million a year contract because of the loss of trust. But back to your statement, the leaders should be having those discussions. And remember when we said, if you give leaders models and have them use them, then the workers will use them. A pre-task brief would be called something different for a leader, but it's the same damn thing.
Mm.
What could happen? What's the worst thing that could happen? You know, I've seen incidents. A guy got his fingertip cut off. And ultimately, it went back to a management decision to tell the purchasing department that they weren't allowed to buy anything in the next 2 quarters that wasn't on the critical equipment list.
Mm.
Go back to that decision and say, what's the worst thing that could happen, or what could go wrong here if we do this? What are some of the things that may not be on the critical equipment list that we might need? What's the worst thing that could happen? Their worst thing that could happen probably wasn't someone gets their finger cut off, but isn't it amazing that that was tied so directly to that manager decision to put a hold on what they were allowed to buy?
I love that. And I think, I talked about the 10th person or something like that for a while. I don't know if you've seen the film World War Z with Brad Pitt. Great film. I talked about that for a while. And I actually think, if I remember rightly, I've actually got it here. I think in volume 2 of the Human Performance Improvement Manual, I think they've actually got Devil's Advocate as a kind of error reduction tool or something. Or
it's been in there for some time.
Yeah,
to assign a devil's advocate. It's in our knowledge worker. So engineers and subject matter experts design phase.
And I think as what that does is, and then to bring it back to the original point about that film, they kind of in that film, basically they go, Brad Pitt's this inventor. I'm not spoiling the film, but you know, if anybody's really funny about spoilers, # spoiler alert. But he basically like, right, he's the investigator for the UN, right? Bring him in. He's all beautiful with his long hair and stuff. And then we finally get to the point where he goes, right, we need to go and talk to the people who are doing well with this virus, who's dealing with, well, let's go to Israel, I think it was. And they go there and they say, how come you're all so prepared? How did you know? Like, did you know this was coming? And if you did know, how did you know? And he said, no, it came up in a memo, and basically that same memo went everywhere and all the governments just disregarded it. They were like, not a credible risk, right? But in Israel or whatever country it was, they had this rule called the 10th person or the 12th person or whatever it was, right? And it was, if the entire board agree, the 10th person must disagree and plan accordingly. So they did under this rule. They disagreed and planned accordingly. So they assumed that this zombie virus would cause an outbreak and planned a whole plan, resources, got it all ready. If it happened, this is what we do. It was professional devil's advocate is what it was.
Yeah, but exactly.
Given the resources to do it. And I just think, imagine if the government had a 10th person for COVID when they first got told about it, or when they first talked about pandemics back in 1979 or something, I think it was, when we put together a pandemic plan. They went, right, what if it was another kind of SARS-related or unknown virus? Oh, that wouldn't happen. It'll be known to us. Okay, 10th person, you got a plan for a virus that we don't know about. That's not flu. There's something that we're not ready for. Off you go.
And you know, in a company, you could actually set limits on when you need that.
Mm.
If the decision's over $100,000, depending on your size of your company.
Yeah, the severity of that decision, I suppose.
We have layers or levels in our company that people are authorized to make independent decisions at one level, but we have what's called the Operations Advisory Council. They have to go to the OAC and plead their case.
So,
you know, we were talking about to create sustainability from integration, it has to become the way you do business. Mm-hmm. So if the leadership team forgets to sign the devil's advocate, forgets to say in a management meeting on budget, what could go wrong? What's the worst thing that could happen? Then someone makes sure that happens. That's sustainability. But isn't that actually an internal evaluation of our capacity and resilience?
Yeah.
Because we put these concepts in and integrated them into the way we do business. And anyone can raise that concern. That makes us sustainable. The next person that comes into the leadership team is going to be taught, this is how we do business. But it's a capacity evaluation at every step. Do we have the capacity and capability to handle this? Mm-hmm. So at the worker level, that's called individual capabilities versus task demand match or mismatch. Right. This person on this task at this time may or may not have the individual capabilities that match the task we're asking them to do. Mm-hmm. The father, individual capabilities versus task demands in mowing the yard was very high, been doing it for decades. The son's individual capabilities versus task demands on the identical task was very different because he didn't even know about the wellhead.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he knew about it because he'd tripped over it as a kid and they, you know, played G.I. Joes in it and things like that, but he didn't know it had anything to do with mowing the yard. Mm. So the same thing applies for these leaders that are making decisions. And what we like to work in is that, circling all the way back to 2 months ago, is intentionality. That when leaders are educated so that the intentionality is integrated into a sustainable way that they do business. They'll do a values-based engagement. Somebody comes back and says, hey, you know, I went to the North region, and every time I talked to somebody in the North region, they implied or directly stated they don't trust you as far as they can throw you. And I don't think they can throw you very far. So we should talk about that. And that is self-esteem awareness. Now we're aware of a challenge. We can have that pre-task brief, the leadership briefing on what are we going to do about this? And if that's what we decide to do, what could go wrong? And what's the worst thing that can happen? How are we going to mitigate those consequences or keep them from happening? Isn't that the same conversation we force workers to have every single day? Oh, wait, you're going to change paper clips? Do you have your gloves on? Have you done a pre-task brief? Oh, you're getting on the ladder? It's a two-step ladder in the office. Do you have a spotter?
A harness?
Yes. Do you have a spotter and a harness? And have you put the engineered tie-off points into the plastic ceiling? Mm. You know, we drive those things down to workers, But the real decisions, you know, ORCHSC and I'm going to get them wrong. Tom Krause's old group and a couple of other people did some research on 375 fatalities a few years ago. What they called sentinel decisions, the decision that started the cascade that ultimately resulted in the fatality, 95% of those sentinel decisions were made above the field level. Not first line supervisor, not crew leader, not worker, manager or above. So do we have a dog in the hunt for creating leaders that have this integrated sustainably into the way they do business that increases the organizational capacity to deal with these things? You damn right we do.
And that will be everywhere. Like you said, like 95%, that is like there is always context. And this is what brings me back to that conversation. If you want capacity and you want resilience, then don't even entertain the conversation of blame, because there's just very little value there. Let's just talk about how do we keep building capacity to fail and resilience. And then if we do that, we focus on that. Every time we choose to learn from something, either a positive or negative event, that's our focus. We will continue to become more and more and more resilient. Resilience being a state that really we can never actually achieve. It's more a kind of aspiration.
Isn't safe the same way?
Well, exactly. It's exactly the same, isn't it? It's a relative term. And this is always my issue with a lot of these conversations where people put a video or a picture on LinkedIn of, look at these idiots doing these stupid roles. And I put one on the other day. I didn't put a thing on. I commented to one of them. Well, these two guys, one's leaning over the edge of a building, painting it. The other's just kind of, he looks like he's hanging on. Is that unsafe? In most people's perception of safe, yes, right? Or is it, I think a better way to describe it would be, is it increased risk of a negative event? Yes. Is it unsafe? Not one of us can answer that question, because safe.
But everybody answers it.
Yes, exactly. But safe is a relative term. And so I comment on it being, I said, like all these people are like, oh my God, look at these clowns, look at these idiots, they should be fired, blah, blah, blah. You've seen it all before, Rob. And I just commented, all I see is two guys getting the job done, trying to pay the bills and put food on the table.
I stopped making the comments because, you know, people turn into trolls.
Oh my God, I'm getting trolled.
I'm going to say this wrong, but I've got to watch my credibility a little bit, you know? So
it is difficult. You know, I also, you know, I get what you're saying, because I've chose to not engage with those people, because people are now actually, this one was only about a week or two ago, and I've learned now, I'm looking at it and I'm like, do you know what, James, you stopped commenting on these posts for a reason. And now you have, maybe it was just a bad day, but let's learn from it, because people are now challenging my credibility. People are commenting on there going, oh, you're apparently a head of health, safety and environment. You're obviously incompetent. I'll be seriously worried for your employer. You know what I mean? And then I'm like, hang on a minute, I've lost my job based on what? Based on the fact that I'm
doing... Which is happening all over the place today.
Yeah.
Another ridiculous conversation that we have to have.
Yeah. But ultimately, it's the same. It's exactly the same problem, is that you're blaming me because apparently, in your opinion, I'm incompetent, but there's context to the reason why I put that comment.
Yeah.
The same way,
because you didn't understand the context. Because they didn't understand the context. You were trying to teach them something. We're back to education.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
They really don't want to learn. Yeah. And you know, for a while there, they would say, what do you think about this? And I would say, genius or inventive or
innovative. Or,
innovative. So, and then I'd just stop because, you know, it's the way I think. Mm. But that's the wrong venue to try to
change,
because you're just so outnumbered with the BS, with people that don't understand. But that, you know, that tells us that the need for what we're doing is grand.
Oh yeah, massive. And this stuff is affecting people every single day. Like I think back to an example that I have from healthcare, and in a highly secure mental health unit, and the context of for nearly every bad decision was rife, like understaffed, poor design building, misplaced patients, you know, high need, real highly kind of dangerous patients in like a mid secure level, and so on and so, like, so on and so forth. A lot of untrained staff or staff that are not allowed to restrain people for medical reasons, and so on and so forth. And all of the stories that I would hear out of that example, the result was always blame the worker. You know, two people left early, or this was left out here, or that was left out here. Right, bit of paper, get the worker in, or we'll fix a problem with another checklist, get the worker in and we'll blame them. But actually the context to that decision, the context to that action was rife, absolutely rife.
And if I could circle back to something I think we talked about in the first month, and that is that too many people think that there's a culture of blaming workers. Mm. And I think that as humans, it's our human instinct to blame.
Yeah.
It's an emotion. So people can be, yeah. And it's a natural reaction,
yeah,
that you can then educate people to react differently or respond differently. So
because also blame, Rob, on that point, sorry to interrupt you, but also I think that we have to acknowledge that the reason why we are so keen to blame is because it fundamentally makes us feel safe. If I can go, that was Rob's fault, Rob's just an idiot, I'm not an idiot, therefore I'm safe. It's like right. A subconscious psychological safety that I get from blaming you and just telling you you're an idiot.
And we've been doing this as long as humans have been around.
Hundreds of millions of years, yeah.
And so I think too many organizations, I don't think it's been that long.
You just said hundreds of millions. Yeah. Someone's going to be like,
I just let it go.
James, come on, James. I'm sorry. I'm not good with numbers.
Billions
okay?
and billions. But you know, if we can get people, especially leaders, educated to blame being a natural human tendency that is manageable, then they can build that into they can integrate that into the way that they do business. In other words, we don't allow another leader to blame. I'm not going to blame. I'll realize when I'm doing it. And I'm not going to allow James to blame either. So when we have those leadership meetings and somebody did something stupid, that they should have been more careful and paid more attention and be more situationally aware, then when people start rattling those off, the devil's advocate in the room is then going to say, what makes you believe that?
Mm.
Prove that to me. Mm-hmm. Prove to me that this is a bad person that did a bad thing intentionally to either hurt themselves, someone else, or your plan.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm saying. No, that's exactly what you said.
What you said, Jim.
So now let's back. And so oddly enough, I'm on the phone with a improvement team the other day, and I had to say, okay, I need everybody that thinks that these are two bad people that did a stupid thing and tried to damage the equipment and almost wound up killing somebody. I need y'all to come out of the closet right now. That's why you're all talking.
Yeah.
So let's get it on the table, and we need you to prove to the rest of us that that's true.
One of my favorite exercises to do around that, you've got like that kind of investigation, that learning what it process after the event, whatever you want to call it. And I always tried to say, right, a little exercise we're going to do today is we're going to try and come up with a couple of contributory factors to this kind of event. And we're going to try and come up with some mitigations to kind of make us more resilient in the future. And just for this little mini exercise, we are not allowed to mention human error. The human is not involved in this process whatsoever, and none of the mitigations can be targeted on the human. Let's just see what we come up with. Just completely forget there's a human there.
That was exactly the conversation we had. And we already had 13 things in the system around it.
Mm.
And what I finally did a little bit out of frustration as the, you know, remote facilitator was I said, y'all are going to now have to prove to me that those 13 things we discovered are all BS.
Yeah.
Well, we're not saying they're BS. Well, then how did they get there? Mm. And you don't think those 13 things impacted the individual in some way? Mm. You don't think the belief that if the system goes offline, this very powerful customer would get pissed off at them mattered in any way in that moment to them?
Yeah. And there's just so many examples I can give to this, but just another kind of healthcare, high secure kind of healthcare example. It's like a situation where two bank staff, there was two of them on a bank shift. And long story short, this was a medium secure unit. So knives, forks, things like that are kind of locked away. And there's a contraband kind of cupboard, which is locked away in a completely different room, so on and so forth. And the patients are allowed to do like a wet shave every now and then, but it's under very strict processes, right? These two bank staff, so if you don't know what bank staff is, it's basically like there's just some work comes on on a web page and you're waiting, you're a bank staff and you're just waiting. So, there's 2 hours of work there. I'll take that.
I'll take it.
So you're not used to working on that ward. You're not used to working in that hospital. You know, you might be, you might not, but ultimately anyone can take that bank staff work, right? So these two people take the bank staff on a night shift where you're less staffed anyway in a night shift. Things are a bit more, you've got less capacity to fail essentially on a night shift. Right, because typically they're all asleep and there's less of a risk. So, okay, makes a bit of sense. Long story short, this high risk patient was kind of saying, "I want a wet shave." Right, okay, fine. These bank staff, you know, asked the bank staff. They said, "Yeah, that's fine." They took him out of the room into the room where the contraband is. So there's now two bank staff and this very strong high risk patient in the room, opened contraband cupboard, big risk in this moment right now. And luckily nothing happened, near miss, but comes back through. They go in, kind of normal staff for the ward, kind of, you know, what's going on? Why is he kind of allowed that right? What happened here? And Jesus Christ, it went nuts. What did they do?
You did what?
Yeah. What did they do? Blame the bank staff. Yeah. Blame the bank. We're not having them too. They're idiots. Well, hang on a minute. What's the context here? How did you as an organization have a system that allowed that to happen?
Yeah.
Because these people are in this secure unit for a reason. So if you're a bank staff in that moment, you know, there's so many things going through your head. You could come off a low secure ward where you don't have to worry about that stuff. So you're like, well, I've never had to worry about that before. Yeah, sure. Here you go. Here's your razor.
And the reality is the organizational decision to not make sure that the people that they're bringing in know the risks.
I know, right?
Is selling the risk to the lowest bidder.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's we had that discussion last time. Yeah. That these big organizations, they sell the risk to the lowest bidder and then blame the lowest bidder for the risk coming true.
Yeah. And this is where it comes back to all of those points that we're covering today, that education of those two members of staff when they started on that shift, of those patients, this ward, what it looks like, you know, didn't happen. Integration of how we're managing these concepts. So integrating that idea of kind of verbalizing what we're doing, or that kind of pre-job brief or pre-task brief or something like that. Imagine if they'd have voiced that out loud or done a pre-job brief between the two, what we're doing, right? We're going to take him through to that area. Actually, now I say it out loud, that feels a little bit like we shouldn't do that, which is then make sure that that ward is sustainable, that the process of having a bank staff is sustainable, which ultimately gives us some capacity and resilience.
Yeah.
just looking at
and you can do that on you can do that on almost anything that has a predictive risk.
Yeah.
And look, a lot of our, I get it, there's things that sneak up on us, but we know a lot of risk.
Do you think, Rob, that one of the biggest issues, I may have alluded to this, kind of touch on this earlier, but one of the biggest challenges, and I'm going to have to tie this in a loop in a minute because my wife's got to go physio. One of the biggest risks is that we kind of put a lot of weight on likelihood. So when we have those kind of high severity situations, we go, yeah, but it's not very likely. So I'm not going to do anything about it, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but okay, it's not very likely, but what if it did happen? Oh, they're dead. They're definitely dead.
Right. Yeah.
But it's not very likely. But hang on a minute. Are you telling me that it's not very likely, but it's still kind of plausible is probably a better way to say it. And you're going to do nothing about it, even though you just admit the guy's going to die.
Yeah.
That, I think that's a big issue.
Yes. You know, we invent, we make up probability.
Mm.
We use what I call our MSU degree. We make shit up.
I'm stealing that MSU degree. That is fucking beautiful. Oh, I'm stealing
that. You know, went to 4 years of uni. Yeah. Make shit up.
Oh, that is so good.
Yes, likelihood is all contextual.
Mm.
100% contextual. Likelihood has nothing to do with one in a million years.
No. And I just wrote an article for my day job on this because we've just had the kind of half year stats come out in the UK for the fatalities within our year. And we're already up by 29 versus last year. Granted, last year was a bit different, but we're still up than the prior year to that as well. And I kind of had this conversation in this article that I wrote, in that one of the main issues, I think, is this over-reliance on likelihood. And I just think that, oh, I've lost my point. What was I going to say? It's complete.
You just wrote an article. We were talking about how likelihood is you just make it up.
That's it. Sorry. Thank you very much for that, Rob. Because I saw that point float away from me as I was saying it. And I was like, no, don't go. And I made the argument to say, the categories are that are regular. So the top three, which is fall from height, struck by a vehicle, and then I think the other one was struck by like a falling object or like a swinging object or anything like that. They are consistently for like the last 5 years, the top contributors to fatal accidents, right? And I've challenged everyone in this article. Go and have a look at your risk assessment. Find those three types of risk in your risk assessment and have a look at the likelihood that you've put on there. Because I guarantee it says low. What have you based that on? Because the actual data in the UK is telling you that it's not likely. Actually, they're telling you it's quite likely because for the last 5 to 10 years, these consistently have killed 100 and X amount of people every year. So to me, that's data to say, stop trying to kid yourself. This is likely.
And look, we know the top 12 fatal hazards.
Mm.
Why would we be talking about likelihood?
Mm.
If it's one of those hazards, why is likelihood in the mix?
Yeah, I agree. I think it needs to come off. To be honest, I don't, if I'm ever teaching somebody or facilitating a risk assessment or anything like that, the first thing I do is remove likelihood and severity from that
conversation. And I still put it in so that people think about it when they're doing something like creating a process.
Yeah.
So that tells you how much level of detail does the process need? You know, do I even need a process? But for the stuff that we already know, I'm sorry we ran out of time. This has been great.
Yeah, I'm looking at the clock being like, I wish I had another hour, but I definitely don't. Right. Well done for kind of bringing that to a loop.
When my next quarter comes around in about 8 years, I'll really look forward to that.
Nice one, Rob. Thank you very much. Do you want to just give us a kind of brief overview of what we've kind of talked about, and then a shout out to your company and the work that you do?
Yeah, no worries. Thank you. So we've done 3 months. First one was on leaders and the important. Second one was on the workforce and their importance. And we got in some pretty good level of detail. And today was about how we deploy. How do you make this happen? And of course, we went on some great journeys on all three of those. That kind of leads to, you know, James very nicely offering for a plug. But for me, it's not really a plug. We have a huge amount of free information on all of these things. Just about everything we talked about in the last three sessions is somewhere in a 2 to 5 minute video or a webinar, or, you know, we have a webinar that we did for the shipping industry called Going Beyond Unsafe Acts and Unsafe Conditions. How do I get the mindset set beyond that? Mm-hmm. And that's on online.improvewithfit.com. And you can go there, join for free. There's all kind of tons of material, but there's also some certification processes that are on there. You can certify procedure writers. You can certify incident analysts. So you can buy some courses on there as well. And you can always visit our website at improvewithfit.com. And as we learn, as we continue to grow in our knowledge, just like understanding how the helicopter lifts heavy loads compared to how a hummingbird and a bee work, we continue to load those things on. When we learn as explorers and pioneers, we share with people that need it every day, and we hope you'll join us. I really appreciate the opportunity to be your co-host for these 3 months, James. I can't say enough about that.
No, it's great to have you on, and a nice different style as well. I enjoyed it, and good to just kind of get real stuck into these kind of actual tangible stories and implementation techniques and stuff. It's been really insightful. So thank you very much, Rob.
Good.
I should put all the links and stuff in the description so that everyone can get it pretty easy. But thank you very much for your time, Rob, and it's been great having you.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Okay, peeps. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rob. Thank you very much, Rob, for being our quarterly co-host. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. It's been a really nice, different way of doing it compared to the first quarterly co-host. It was really different as well. And I'm really enjoying the kind of cognitive diversity and the diversity of styles and stuff that this is bringing. And I'm kind of enjoying kind of handing over the reins a little bit to the quarterly co-host and letting them kind of explore their kind of ideas and so on, and us enabling those ideas. So if you've got something you're desperate to talk about, you're thinking, I could do with about 3 hours of content and I could fill that with my idea, or I've always wanted to have a conversation with these types of people or whatever. You've got an idea, you've got something you want people to know more about, the quarterly co-host slot could be the right option for you. Next quarter, we have an amazing lady coming on who I've been talking to for a while. She's been on the podcast before, and she's just an outstanding lady. She currently is the head of safety for Sainsbury's. Previously was the head of safety for BT Openreach as well. Her name's Crystal Danbury. If you know her, then you know how amazing she is, and she's going to come on and be our quarterly co-host as well. I'm going to keep the subject secret for now, and you'll have to check in a few weeks' time to find out what we're going to talk about, but I'm really, really looking forward to it. Hope you've enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance Learning Organization webinar and the HSE subscription service. Don't forget to check out Project Meletium. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rate and review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. Do something positive, share it, subscribe, like it, because all of that helps us get into more people's faces and expose people to these different ideas and better ways of working. And ultimately, it helps us help you. You know, the more people that listen helps us kind of spread the word, but it helps us upgrade our content and so on and so forth. So thank you very much for watching. I'll catch you later. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.